when we start looking back a little bit into human history, we find a tendency that continues and revives itself constantly over the course of ages. When, by circumstances, largely due to ourselves, we get into difficulties which we cannot control and for which we have no practical solution, there is always the same tendency to turn back again to the basic faith of our people or our race. This is a time when this type of situation is being re-emphasized. In the last 5 years, the increase of religious interest has been phenomenal, and it is increasing constantly with new and more important and more interesting contributions arriving every day. Actually, however, in the past where we've had this type of experience, we have tried desperately to accomplish a particular good and have had great problems trying to accomplish that which we hope for. A word maybe at this time would be interesting in connection with the life and labors of William Penn, the Quaker. William Penn founded what he termed, or established what he termed, the Holy Experiment. This experiment was the result of gaining a grant of land in the Western Hemisphere and building there what is now the state of Pennsylvania. But the Holy Experiment was to establish a free and independent state without an army, without war, without a militia, without treaties, and without any violence or persecution, with personal liberty of thought and complete equality of religion. Now, this is what he came over here to do. And it worked for 76 years, just about the way he planned it. It worked because he started in, probably, with the first remarks that are recorded relating him to the King of England. He came to the King of England to have a grant, and it was given to him. And, as was usual in those days, to gain a territorial grant had some expenses involved in it. There had to be a payment to the crown. So when Penn was ready to leave, he made a short visit to the king. And the king wished him well. And he said, "What are you going to do when you get over there?" Penn said, "The first thing I'm going to do is buy the land from the Indians." Well, he says, "You've already bought it from me." He said, "We don't count that, sire. We don't count any payment until it is paid to the rightful owners." That was way back in the 17th century. And it started that way and went along that way. And in all the years of Penn's life and his direct descendants, there was never a day of trouble with the Indians. While all the other colonies were in grave danger, they had made treaties, they made them, and they kept them. And the success of this experiment resulted in something else. Many, many persecuted groups in England, Germany, Poland, and the northern states, finding a possible place where they could worship God according to the conviction of their own conscience, came and settled within Penn's domain. And Penn was the one who accepted them all, cherished them all, and gave not one of them authority to dominate a completely temperate religious atmosphere. Now, this was a holy experiment, he called it that. And it worked for quite a long while. And what destroyed it? What brought it to an end? The increasing complexity of colonization, the constant squabbling in other areas, and the gradual intensification of economic policies, the desire for territory, for sale and building of towns and cities, little by little, the control slipped away from Pennsylvania. But for a long time, it worked. And today, I think we are all standing on the verge of the need for another holy experiment. Something to prove that problems can be solved without violence, without dishonesty, without propaganda, and without interference in the rights of the individual to think, and to establish still in this world a commonwealth in which the primary purpose is that all persons should have security of thought and life. So all this happened nearly 300 years ago. And it is something we can bring with us, I think, perhaps, to a little thought on this Easter Sunday morning. And here we are confronted with a word in the Bible, occurring in the use I want to make of it in the third chapter of Proverbs. And that is the word righteousness. Now, righteousness doesn't appear in that verse, but the concept behind it appears in it. And this verse says, referring to wisdom, the length of life is in her right hand, honors and riches in her left hand. Now, in our modern world, we've been dealing pretty heavily with the left hand of God. But we haven't been quite so thoughtful of the right hand. Now, righteousness comes from the word right. And when we study that word, not only in spelling and pronunciation, but in all its usages and divisions of usage, we find that it is a very remarkable word. In the biblical sense of it, righteousness means rightness. And rightness in the Bible means obedience. Obedience to the laws of God and the laws of nature. Obedience is therefore the basis of right living, right thinking, right hoping, right building, right planning. And all these things must be governed by a power superior to man. When the human being tries to take this over and run it himself, he gets into trouble. He has always gotten into trouble. And the trouble has always continued until the human being becomes aware that there are rules that he cannot break, and that the rules that he makes live only to the degree that they obey the rules of life and nature. So gradually, by degrees, we get into a left-handed situation in which wealth and honor and power take control of conduct. And as a result of that, empires, nations, races, communities fall apart. And in their fall, bring down the individual with his small but significant problems. Now, what are the laws with which we must learn ultimately to work? They are the laws that are expressing themselves constantly in every aspect of existence as we see it. I've been much interested recently in a number of nature films that have been shown on television, in which we find definite indications of the rudimentary principles of universal law. Many of these rules are difficult for us to understand, but we know that creatures comparatively humble and with practically no intelligence as we know it, are able to fulfill destinies which have been established by powers superior to themselves. Therefore, living or existing is very largely a problem of fulfilling destiny, to continue the thing as it should be, to do the work that is next, and to keep on striving for the ultimate good, which is universal security. This is the problem that we face, and it has been in many ways distorted and disabled by human activities. Now, today science is hard at work solving all kinds of wonderful mysteries of nature. We are out looking into the galaxy for this and into the inner parts of the earth for something else. We are experimenting, building, contriving, conspiring. to enlarge the frame of human domination over life. But the principle is wrong. We are not here to dominate life. We are here to fulfill life. Because life itself is something we do not control, do not understand, and are not in any immediate danger of solving as a problem. We are here to fulfill the purpose of humanity. And this is clearly set forth in most of the biblical writings of both the Old and the New Testaments, that we are here to do what we ought to do, and not just what we want to do. If we break the rules, either from ignorance or from perversity of temperament, we are going to be in trouble. And we have been breaking these rules regularly for thousands of years. Things get worse. Problems increase and multiply. And knowledge expanding towards the solution of material things ends in a spiritual and intellectual disaster. We are here, therefore, to say that science has to make certain changes in its perspectives. It is charming and wonderful to develop and perfect computers. It is a delightful problem to examine the ashes of the past and sift the sands of Babylon. It is very happy to go out and explore the habits of bugs and birds. But if these explorations and these researches do not contribute to the solution of the human problem, we are wasting a lot of time which we do not have available to waste much longer. Therefore, the problem in every matter is to find out the full meaning of righteousness, and that each individual must attain a state of righteousness. Now, one of the basic meanings of righteousness is to be right, to be what we should be. And what is rightness? According to religion, and for that matter, morality and ethics, and almost all of the great philosophical systems, to be right means that cheerfully, lovingly, and happily we keep the rules by which our kind can perpetuate itself. We have to keep the rules. If we keep these rules, they will keep us. If we break them, the broken rules will break us. Now, all knowledge, all learning, all study, all thought should involve some lesson, some participation in the large policy of the things we need to know, the discoveries we should be making, and the problems we should be solving. Also, in the biblical sense of the word, righteousness means according to the will of God. Now, God is an abstract term which man has created to distinguish the great universal conscious intelligent physical energy, the divine power, the divine realities behind all of the manifestations of creation. In other words, somewhere at the root of things is that which is eternal, that which also has rules that are unbreakable. When men say they break the law, what they really say is they are breaking themselves. Because the lawbreaker says, I have a stomachache. That doesn't mean he broke the law. The disobedience to it damaged his stomach. The law goes on. No one breaks it, but those who try to break themselves against it as against a rock. Now, this law sounds kind of formidable. It sounds as though it's going to take all the joy out of life. And that is where theology got into some difficulties. Theology gradually obsessed the human being with a sense of sin that has bothered him and perverted his attentions for a long time. According to theology, most of it, virtue was a matter of continual and eternal frustration. The individual was expected to do everything he did not like to do for the glory of God. Also, that he was to be miserable for the sake of his own eternal soul. And that he was to live in constant fear of sin and create institution after institution to protect him from sin on the assumption that everything except his own belief was sin. It got very complicated, very unpleasant, and very inadequate. Today we are beginning to recover from some of this, but we still have an idea that that which is good is unpleasant. And why it is unpleasant, if we think for a moment, is that some of the things that we believe to be good are not good. Alcoholism is not good, but for many persons it is a principal reason for living. And as a result of that, is the first cause of dying. All the intemperances which the individual considers to be his prime enjoyments are in some way in conflict with reality. So instead of making him a happy, healthy person, they destroy his life, break his home, pervert his children, and leave him in the end a sickly and miserable disaster. And yet he is certain that he has the right, an inalienable right, to make any mistake that he wishes to without sad consequences for himself. Well, nature just isn't built that way, either divine nature or human nature. Happiness, as we know it, is very largely a matter of dissipation. It is a matter of doing what we please and fulfilling our ambitions, going out of our way, if necessary, to be unpleasant to others, competitive, and often morally dishonest, and that the final virtue of life is the accumulation of wealth or the accumulation of honors and recognitions, not for our realities, but for our physical compromises with truth. Now, this just doesn't seem to be working. A lot of people do not know why it isn't working. They don't see any reason why their own conduct should react on them. They believe that they are entitled to universal divine spoilage. They should do as they please, and an all-forgiving parent overlook everything. Well, when we do that in a family, we're in trouble. When nations do it, they are in difficulties. And when the whole human race tries to do it, we have catastrophe. Actually, there is no reason or right in the belief that we have a right to make mistakes. We have the ability to make them, but that does not make a right before nature. If we make mistakes, we pay for them. And as we look back over history, we seem to realize that for the last 10 or 15,000 years, we have been paying heavily for something. And the only thing we can be paying for is our own mistakes. Therefore, in this particular period, we must come back to this idea of righteousness, as it is found in the Bible and was very well established as a term with particular and definite meanings. Righteousness is therefore the condition of being right. It is always the fact that the individual, under all conditions, chooses to be right in every possible way. Now, there are problems that arise. 9 people out of 10 will tell you they do not know what is right, that they are drifting along on guesses and assumptions and speculations and reading the latest works on the subject by unqualified authors. The question remains is, what is right? Well, I think Lord Bacon gave us a valuable key to this. He said, if you want to know really what is right, see what happens as a result of what you do. If you are in trouble and you look back and you find that you have acted in an unfriendly manner, if you have tried to deceive someone or exploit someone or make unreasonable profits or try to force your own opinions upon others, these are the causes of personal unpleasantness and unhappiness. So if you are right, you are going to have what is probably the most important of all rewards. The reward of right is security. Security in a cheerful, conscious, intelligent, reasonable way. The right to enjoy life rather than to destroy it at its roots. The right to grow, the right to be happy, to establish proper homes, to live in peace, to have the necessities of life. All of these are right, and they are attainable. If public mind and public thinking can ever recognize that right is keeping faith with realities and not the accumulation of worldly goods at mutual expense. So we have now we are trying to find out a little more about the word righteous. Now in religion we have another problem. We have for the most part taken it for granted that salvation was due to the faith in which you are born, or the creed or culture you accept by voluntary acceptance of belief. In other words, salvation is the result of membership. Salvation is the result of building between you and your own conduct, a kind of upholstery by means of which you are saved in spite of yourself. You are saved by Voltaire called a handful of water on that occiput. If you are immersed, submerged, or sprinkled, you are in religion. Now, the original use of the word baptism was very simple. It was washing. It was being clean. And it is still so in many religious groups. And baptism is meaning a cleansing, a change of self, a complete revision of their own code of life, the dedication to righteousness, a dedication to doing those things which are of the common good to all, a determination to hurt no one, a determination to put common good above self-interest, and most of all, an immediate recognition of the importance of forgiving completely and with open heart those who have despitefully used us. Without the works, the words are useless. So all around the world today, religion is gaining ground. Nearly every nation is becoming involved, and half of this religiously involved world is at war with itself. In the name of religion, people are torturing and tormenting themselves, destroying each other, and trying desperately to exploit each other under the name of religion, to build palaces for themselves instead of a happy world for deity. Thus we find that something is wrong in righteousness, and righteousness seems to tell us the answer. That when we claim a religion, it will do us no good unless we live it. If it does not stimulate an improvement of self and an improvement of the inner life of the individual, the right hand gives us length of life and the power to live, but the left hand gives us only honors and riches, which are of this world only and are very treacherous things. So in ancient times, all good deeds were performed with the right hand. We shake hands with the right hand. We perform most of the common purposes of life with the right hand, because most people are right-handed. Then now we find the necessary step is not just to be right-handed, but right-hearted, to understand that there are many labors that have to be performed correctly only by the hand of righteousness, the hand that is set forth for friendship. And while we are thinking about it, we must remember that we cannot afford to shake a man's right hand with ours and have our hands behind our back holding a gun. This type of thing is giving us a lot of trouble. And every day the world is coming closer to something. It is coming closer to the realization that in the great emergency, there is nothing that will solve it for us but the internal experience of the divine will and the hope of perfection through keeping the words, works, and labors of divinity. We can do it. Now, some will say, how can we do it? We can do it, first of all, within the range of the available. And here we can take a very useful little lesson from Buddhism. And that is that it is possible to take the first step. We must take it alone. It cannot be done because society has built a marvelous defense so that if we fall on our faces in the first step, society is going to pick us up. The first step of human development toward realities must be taken by the person with only one hope in his heart, and that is hope itself. The hope that to do it right will result in good. This hope seems to be pretty well justified. We have martyred nearly all the people who were really very right. But long after they are gone, they are the heroes of humanity. They are the saints and gods and sages that we honor most in life, are the ones we had no time for while they were alive. Because we didn't understand then the need for them. We didn't realize that these examples of integrity were the most valuable things that we had in our traditional story of life. So we start out to try to find the way to a personal integration in a confused and problemed planet. Actually, it is not a terrible thing. Everything that is right is finally highly rewarded by its own realities. Reality never punishes. Reality can only stand and wait until it is deserved. So we have no need to fear that if we improve, we're going to be desolated by improvement. We will not be desolated unless the attachments and values we hold in life are so false in themselves that we consider the loss of them to be the supreme tragedy. If the things that we are doing wrong and the attitudes that we are holding that are not reasonable are so delightful to us that we refuse to give them up, then we will have to do what the ancients showed in their art. They showed us disappearing, holding these things in hand and vanishing with them. Today we have a much better concept of some of these values, and right at this time it is very important, I think, for us to recognize the challenge of Easter, the challenge of the resurrection of right, the coming forth of right out of the darkness of death, the coming forth of eternal life from the Holy Sepulchre. The Holy Sepulchre is the world. It is the earth and all that it inhabits. It is our own bodies, our own hearts, our own minds, our own communities, our own home. Every one of these structures, now tottering, now actually graves rather than palaces, all of these structures are waiting patiently for justification so that they can rise victoriously over selfishness, superstition, and crime. And we can start in a little simple way in our own lives. We all have problems every day. And in these problems, we must seek after righteousness. We must also take this basic attitude to try to understand what the universe wants us to do when we are faced with a very important decision. How can we do it for the good of that which is right? How can we make the problem of living part of a program for the releasing of the human soul from bondage to ignorance, superstition, and fear? We can start by reevaluating some of our own problems, looking around to see a society in which the world is moving toward a universal brotherhood, rather than building barrier after barrier to prevent mankind's natural growth and happiness. Those who do not have enough are unhappy. Those who have too much are unhappy. And those who have what they need only are very ambitious to improve the situation. So when our whole civilization as we know it has been built around, gradually around, the idea of the infinite significance of luxury, of actual competitive structure, and scientists who should know better, economists who certainly do know better, and politicians whose knowledge is very dubious, all these people are involved in this. There are very few people that cannot face certain facts with a major amount of thoughtfulness. We know that if we go on at the present time, we're going to exhaust all the resources of nature, and we are hoping that by that time we will devise some new source of researches and resources until finally we go on to inevitable oblivion. Actually, our materialistic science, our world, regardless of its fact that two-thirds of it is religion-oriented, the world basically is atheistic. Atheism in the sense that it ignores principles while claiming to believe them, that affirms the reality of God and pays no attention to the Ten Commandments. This type of thinking must be considered lack of righteousness. Now, I know, and we work a lot with people in their problems, and the lack of righteousness is a basis of sickness. If the individual eats the wrong food long enough, he's going to destroy his health. If he decides to go into narcotics, he's going to destroy his health quicker. If he is deciding to go on in the way he has been thinking from childhood to now, and depending entirely upon authority outside of himself for instruction, he will go right on getting into the same troubles that he's now in, and probably worse ones. Actually, the individual has to do a little thinking about all this. He has to do what every scientist ought to do, and that is have proof that his mistakes are helpful, and this he can't do. He can never prove that being wrong is right. And the fact that all people are wrong doesn't make one bit righter. If the individual, like science with its researching capacities, studies the problems of living as it studies molecules, it would soon show us that there is a moral universe which is just as real and just as susceptible to scientific rules as the physical one. We are just simply overlooking the disagreeable facts which might force us to improve conduct. We do not really want to be better. We talk about it, but down inside, what we want is a larger home and a swimming pool. We hope we can get it honestly. We are very unhappy at the government for taxing us with questionable responsibilities. We believe we should be free from all of these burdens. But what do we do to solve these burdens in our own thinking? A person who is in trouble, after a little while, begins to develop mental difficulties. Now, there are a great many people wandering around the earth in almost every level of society who are not actually insane, but they are intensely neurotic. And neurosis becomes a terrible detriment to character. Neurosis allows the mind to take in food that is poisonous. It does the same thing with the mental and emotional life that we think of in junk calories. The neurotic individual gradually develops all kinds of attitudes. Some neurotics go into religion intensively, develop all kinds of psychic experiences, and try to live by them. Most of these people are in trouble. Others simply declare themselves to be basing their lives upon some kind of a philosophy, like Marx or Engels, and they're in trouble, like the countries that are trying to live by them now. Everyone is in trouble because they have not recognized that honesty is the basis of survival. Honesty interferes with a quick profit. But when everyone thinks of nothing but a quick profit, humanity collapses. It just isn't built that way. Absolutely true in nature is everything has use. right use develops and protects and evolves. Wrong use we call abuse, and wherever it exists, it is a disease. And it is something that gradually becomes a communicatable disease, an infectious disease, and finally destroys the fabric of a complete nation or a complete generation of people. So this morning we want to try to think a little bit about what Easter really suggests to us. First of all, it is a statement for hundreds of millions of Christians of the hope of resurrection. It is the final internal experience or acceptance of the victory of the divine over the human. It is the final statement that while the body is temporal and impermanent, the dweller in the flesh is eternal. And it is this rising of the self over the illusions of existence, the release of the inner life from slavery to appetites and ambitions, the resurrection of realities, of integrities, and of the final spiritual rules which govern all things. The world is a theocracy, no matter how we're going to approach it. And materialism is nothing but a handmaiden, which if properly used will make life more comfortable and pleasant. But if it takes over the authority of the living, ends in war, revolution, and destruction. This type of concept, then, would be more or less suitable to this season. This is the season of the vernal equinox. This is the promised return of the sovereign sun to bring light and peace to the earth. And as the sun shines upon the earth, so the spiritual light of truth shines in the hearts and lives of those who are willing to open themselves to ways of thinking and living that are superior to the ones that are getting them into trouble. So we can start out more or less as individuals to see what we can do as persons to improve the general structure of our society. And the good seed is not lost. And the good seed also grows and bears many fruit. But each individual in his own life has to sow this mustard seed, which is to become a great tree. And it begins with a new attitude toward the way we live, an attitude in which, above all the domination and dictatorship of institutions, whether spiritual or political or industrial, that above all of these is an intimate personal experience of deity. The God in us is more important than anything in the world outside. And each individual having this divine power in himself and the right to live according to it and the right to release conduct is by means of this inspiration. These are things that belong to the new age, the coming world which we all hope for. Utopia is nothing more or less than letting the best in us mingle with the best in all others in a common brotherhood. And until that happens, there is no answer. There are no amounts of armament that can protect us. There are no amount of legislation that can remove our problems. There are no strikes, violence, revolutions, rebellions, or anarchies that will solve anything that can be solved only by the life of enlightened love. There can be no other way. And in emergencies, we realize this. But when the emergency passes, we drop back into the convenient ways of doing everything as easily and painlessly as possible. And as a result of that, the more painless it becomes, the more impossible and painful it will ultimately be. Now, on the word also of the idea that we have here of righteousness, supposing we try to define righteousness in terms of social significance, of social order. What are the problems that we face? Well, we can take a very simple example, perhaps, from the computerizing processes. If we turn the computer upon the problem of righteousness, if we develop the necessary machinery that will tell us the truth about what we have been lying to ourselves about for ages, something good might come out of it. We might learn what no one seems to be willing to know at the present time, that all the problems, mistakes, and delinquencies of the human being can be estimated. The consequences of them can be scientifically demonstrated, and we can live in a world in which the truth is available to all of us, in the sense that keep the rules, and we will survive. Now, the rules, as we say, are not always easy to work with. But we have another factor inside of ourselves that is helpful in this matter, and that is conscience. There is nearly always inside of us that still, small voice, which because of our mistakes has become stiller and smaller in every generation. We do know in our hearts when we are not doing well. When we lose a temper, when we begin to blame other people, we can talk ourselves and do anything we want to. But somewhere down in the depths of our own lives, and through the experiences of living, which we have already passed through, there comes a realization that we are taking a bad chance, that we are very likely going to suffer as a result of a misdeed, that we're going to pay for cruelty, unkindness, and the failure to cooperate in proper and reasonable manners. This is going to get us into trouble. We know this. Somehow we sense it. Therefore, we also feel bad. We feel badly. We feel discouraged when things go wrong. When we lose a friend, we regret it. And even if we know that we are the cause of the loss, we are satisfying ourselves that because the friend has embarrassed us or disappointed us in some manner, but inside we know there was a mistake in it somewhere. That we do not lose friends unless there's something wrong with ourselves. And these broken homes, there's something wrong in those people. It's something that one or both have not been able to control.